Good afternoon. Thanks for coming to this yet another seminar by the Hellenic Observatory in the Research Seminar Series. Today it's a pleasure to have with us Claire Economidou, who is currently a Senior Visiting Fellow at the Hellenic Observatory. She's Associate Professor at the Department of Economics in the University of Piraeus in Greece. And she has previously been Assistant Professor at the Utrecht School of Economics in the Netherlands. Claire has a PhD from the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, and she has studied previously in my beloved city of Thessaloniki. She has a bachelor's degree in mathematics from the Aristotle University of Thessaloniki and an MSc in economics from the University of Macedonia. Her research interests are in the fields of economic growth and the economics of innovation, and the topic of the presentation today is indeed on the economics of innovation. She looks at the issue of knowledge diffusion, the impact on local economic, local innovation, economic growth, the role of financial frictions on national innovation systems, the private value of patents, the role of institutions, social capital in shaping entrepreneurship and innovation. I guess this relates to the Greek dimension of the issue. Claire is a very well-accomplished economist in Greece, and she has published in some very important influential economics journals, including the Journal of Economic Behavior and Organization, the European Economic Review, Journal of Development Economics, and others. Before I pass the floor on to her, let me make two announcements, which I usually forget to make. So, two forthcoming events. Next Tuesday, on the 27th of February, we have the pleasure to be hosting a public lecture by the Minister of Digital Technology, Telecommunications and Media of Greece, Mr. Nikos Pappas. This is a public lecture in a different venue, and it is a ticketed event. So if you're interested in attending, please visit the Hellenic Observatory website and you can find information about how to sign up for a ticket. And then the Tuesday after, on the 6th of March, we have another seminar here in this room, in our research seminars series by Nicole Labropoulou, who is not in the audience, noted, looking on the gender effect of the crisis, in particular on working decisions and the male-female gap in employment participation. So our next event, next Tuesday, 27, with Nikos Pappas, and in 2 weeks' time from now, another seminar on the gender effects of the crisis. So with these announcements, I'm passing the floor to Claire for the presentation.
Thank you, Vasily, and thank you all for being here. I will stand up and present so I can see you all. And I can look actually at your faces, and I can see actually students, professors, researchers, maybe inventors, potentially, some of you in the future, you never know. But definitely, I see a crowd of very educated, well-educated people, skillful people. And people like you, individuals in general, are great reservoirs. They are contain ideas and skills and talents and knowledge. And these actually people contribute in places like you do here or elsewhere. So they have a big contribution in knowledge accumulation. And when these people move, and maybe you move one day from here, from this institution, from this country, and you go elsewhere, then you carry some knowledge with you. So you're important knowledge carriers. So today's seminar has to do about people, very highly skilled individuals, who move around. So I want to investigate what moves people, highly skilled people around, and what is their contribution on local innovation activity. And this topic is very, very important topic in economic growth theory, especially in growth economics, in economics of innovation, and economics of geography. It's a very important topic as well. In many different policy agendas. For instance, back in 2000 and 2008, the European Commission was very much concerned about the mobility of the European people because it has been very, very low, less than 0.3%. So they wanted to make the European area a nice, attractive area to the talented, very smart, very brainy people, and to foster actually the mobility. Also, this is a key policy issue for the European, for the UK Department of Business, Innovation and Skills, how to attract people, talented people, and how to match talent with business. Okay, so what prompted my research it's a set of questions not adequately answered in the literature. For instance, how far inventors stretch in the space, and eventually how effective is the knowledge that they carry. And of course, there is some claims in the literature like the death of distance and the end of geography, the world is flat. So eventually, does geography explain economic phenomena or not anymore? That's the question actually here. Or it explains to some sets of individuals and not to some other set, to other sets. And eventually, how important is the role of technological similarity between countries, cultural proximities and institutions? There is some scant empirical evidence, mainly from some studies of French, Spanish people, and some people here in the LSE, that investigate actually what mobilized people. But my research has to do with the inventors and the highly skilled people, not with any immigrant. And eventually, people move and they go to places. Do they have any important economic impact at the place that they go? That's another set of questions that I'm very much interested to answer. Now, from all human capital, I focus on the very highly skilled human capital, like you people here. But in the upper tail of the highly skilled human capital, which is the inventors, the patent inventors. So you are not patent inventors, I'm not an inventor so far. Maybe in the future some of you will be. But so you're not the set of the people that I'm very much interested here in this research. And why I focus on inventors? Because it's a very specific typology. Very, very small set of workers. But they tend to be very homogeneous when it comes to tertiary education, because all of you may have tertiary education here, bachelor degrees, master's degrees, PhDs, but these are different degrees from different universities, so you're quite a heterogeneous group. Inventors are not that much. And also they have a direct contribution on innovation, because these are the seed of innovation. They think they produce novel ideas and products and processes. You and I can take some time, maybe years, to become inventors and potentially start contributing to innovation. So inventors are very much deeply involved in the production of ideas, which is the core, is the crux of the matter when it comes to the economic growth theory. And also there are vehicles, there are carriers of knowledge. Whenever they move, they carry knowledge with them and they diffuse, they scatter knowledge, they circulate knowledge around, which is very, very much important thing in the economics of innovation, economics of geography, and spatial distribution. Now, where do I fit? Where my research fits in the literature? Broadly, there's an umbrella that discusses what motivates people, the determinants, actually, of international migration mobility. Unskilled, medium-skilled, and highly-skilled people. This is a very broad research. It uses gravity models or pseudo-gravity models and discusses, actually, how important is unemployment, institutions, income, etc. Now, my research actually speaks loudly, mostly to the literature of the very, very talented, highly skilled people, such as the inventors themselves. And there, actually, you can see few research. The research is very thin, actually, and Miguel, Moreto, and a couple of other guys from Bordeaux, discuss actually the drivers of this set of highly talented people. Now, another set of questions is, okay, some people move, the very highly talented people, and they go somewhere. Once they go somewhere, do they do something important, or they just go there and the whole thing dissipates, eventually nothing happens? So, a couple of guys, this is a Turkish guy from Harvard and his PhDs, work on historical and current evidence in the US. So how the immigrants brought technology in the US and how important was the immigration in the US when it comes to knowledge accumulation. Now in the UK, it's Crescenzi and Cagliari, the two Italian guys, Bocconi and LSE, that discuss actually the interregional mobility and the innovation and firms behavior. In the UK, they use this community innovation survey data. And when it comes to the EU regions, there's a big project for the WIPO organization, and the leader is Ernesto Migueles, a good friend of mine. He investigates actually the regional innovation mobility and some spatial effects. What I do here, I'm mostly related to this literature of Michelez et al. So I'm discussing about inventors. And also, I don't use only European regions. I use actually 30 countries, 30 OECD countries. And I approach the whole matter quite differently from Michelez et al. Studies. I will explain why. So what's the aim here? The aim is twofold. Of course, first I want to see the inventor movers. What actually are the determinants for people to move, the inventors, and then actually to assess their impact on local innovation activity. Now the question is how to track inventors. So when you have a great idea, you go to a patent office, that can be the European Patent Office or the US Patent Office or the Japanese Patent Office, and you file your patent, you apply for your patent. 1.5 years later, then you may grant the patent, so you get the patent. And on the patent, there is a paper that says, me, Claire Economy, do today, I file for this patent, and eventually this patent is granted to me, and this is my address. For instance, Washington, D.C. Then I move to London, and then I file for another patent. And then I'm lucky enough, and I get the patent. Then I say, me, Claire Economy, do today, London, my address in London, Holborn, etc. So I went, me and my co-authors, and actually tracked thousands of individuals who moved from country to country and filed for patents and got the patent. And actually from the patent wrapper paper, we tracked their address. So for every individual, I know where he went, or she went, and whether she filed for a patent, got the patent or not. This is how we track actual inventors. This is a very convenient, this is the only way actually in the literature. Then we use gravity models, bilateral models, and see actually bilateral flows from the destination, from the origin country to the destination actually, the flows. That's the right, the left, the right-hand side, I'm in the UK. And the dependent variable, while the independent variables can be number of batch variables like institutions, technology, geography, and a couple of other things. Okay, so three questions. I'm going to ask this, hopefully, these three questions in this limited time today. What shapes international mobility of inventors? As a comparison, I will bring the non-inventors here. So what shapes actually the national mobility of the non-inventors, the simple migrants, in the same framework. This thing has been done for the first time in the literature. And eventually, what is the impact of the inventors on local innovation? Okay, a map, which is not very successful, because I can see now that the colors are not very bright. But this is the very much interesting, attracting places for inventors in the EU28. And as you can see, Germany, it's France, and the UK, and Switzerland. And when it comes to the OECD, again, you see these three or four European countries to single out, and the US and Japan. Now, I have 840 country pairs. But here, in this network, I plot only the top 5%, so the 68 country pairs. And as you can see, when it comes to inventors, the most attractive place is the US. And people from Canada, inventors from Canada, UK, and Germany flow there. Then second best country is Germany. And Austrian people, French people, UK people go to Germany. The UK ranks fourth and attracts inventors mainly from France, Germany, and Italy, and then it's the Netherlands.
So just a clarification. So these are people who have filed, so for example, the USA, these Canadians who have filed for a paid patent in Canada first,
mm-hmm. And then
you don't actually know the nationality or...
No, exactly.
Okay. So it could also be people from, let's say, from Japan that go to the USA before they file something in Japan.
Exactly.
And you don't see them.
No.
Yeah. Okay.
I see the residency. So Canadian people, or people who live in Canada, they tend to go and file for patents in the US. So they move there. Let's see what happens to the non-inventors, the civil migrants. Here, the attractive place is Germany, and attracts inventors from Poland, Italy, and Hungary. UK comes second when it comes to immigrants, civil immigrants, and attracts people from Poland, inventors, non-inventors, right? Simple people, simple migrants. Polish, US people, and Germans. Then third is the USA, from Korea, Canada, and the UK, and then Spain and Japan. So there are different profiles, eh? Where the inventors go and where the non-inventors go. And the question is why they choose this countries, eh? For what reasons? So here my gravity models comes into to explain a couple of things, and eventually my decision to move or not to move depends on my utility. So I compare my utilities here, my country, versus the expected utility in the other country that I'm going. And if it's bigger enough, then I move. And of course, geography captures the transaction costs or the monetary cost of moving out. But there are also non-monetary costs, like, I mean, I go to a new place, I don't know the technology of the new place, I need some time to adjust. Also, maybe religious, culture-wise, the place is very different. So this is also non-monetary cost that I have to incur. So as you can see here, this is a typical gravity model. These are the flows, the bilateral flows between country J and I. And then you see actually geographic factors. Now, you may wonder why you have these numbers there, like 300, 1,000 something. These are not ad hoc numbers. From the 30 OECD countries that I have, I took the pair of countries that lays the furthest apart, and this is Japan and Portugal. And then the neighbor countries, Slovakia and Austria. These countries are they're very close to each other, less than 60 kilometers away. And then I start making this taxonomy. I start, you know, dividing the geography into batches of this kind of distance. And ideally, I would like to have the same countries, the same number of countries within each class, because otherwise, maybe class can be very small and can create distortions. So look, let's take this number, 1,100. So these are the neighboring countries. Below 1,100 is the neighboring countries. What I mean is the following. I take Italy and France. These are neighboring countries. They share one common border, right? But their capital cities are very far away. Surprisingly enough, they're very far away. They're 1,100 kilometers. And then below 1,100 kilometers, you have other neighboring countries, like Slovakia and Austria, Austria and Germany, Germany and Poland, right? So the neighboring countries, I cluster them in two groups, below 300 kilometers and above 300 kilometers till 1,000. Maybe it sounds confusing, but I can explain later after the presentation if you like. But the point is, I want to disentangle two phenomena, the distance from the border. And there are many bordering countries in Europe in close proximity, and there are many bordering countries in Europe in far proximity. So I have two groups here. My benchmark is neighboring countries, which are actually the area of 30 kilometers. And then I have neighboring countries beyond the area of 300 kilometers till the distance of 1,000. And then here I have non-neighboring countries. Non-neighboring countries, non-neighboring countries, non-neighboring countries, right? So only one set of neighboring countries, the far countries, the far neighboring countries, because the close neighboring countries is my benchmark. Then I have density, population over area. Then I have the number of inventors in these countries. And I catch all a control set, Z, that has other things. Also, I'm explaining actually this distance classification. I have a technological proximity because some people travel, they ignore the distance, and they travel because the technological distance is very far or very close. Technological distance in the literature of economics of innovation is captured mainly by the difference in the log R&D over scientists. This is the technological effort of a country. How much R&D you spend on how many people. Then a second measure of technological proximity comes from Hall, Brownian Hall et al. Jaffa, it's very common actually in this literature to create this index. So I take the distribution of all patents that I have in Greece, in all sectors. Sector food, 5 patents. Sector textile, 9 patents. And then I take the distribution of all patents in Germany per sector. And then I create actually a correlation index between these two distributions and say, if the correlation is big, then I say, okay, these two countries are very close when it comes to the technologies. If the correlation is very small, I say these two countries are very far away when it comes to the technologies, eh? To the patterns they produce per sector. Cultural, highly ignored in the literature till very recently. Cultural saves, of course, people, and saves innovation. And there's a Dutch guy, Hofstede, has a beautiful book about how cultural saves innovative minds, and it says, well, cultural things can create hierarchies. You can have feminine cultures, masculine cultures, hierarchical cultures, collective cultures, individualistic cultures, and religion and language plays a huge role. So imagine a culture which is very hierarchical. You have a great idea, you go to your boss, and your boss tells you, wait, that's not your day today to talk, or you have to wait for me to express myself first. So you cannot be very innovative, and you cannot catch up with other companies, you cannot fill the market, you cannot actually immediately act. You are not proactive. You have to wait and wait for others. So how can capture culture? Well, I can capture culture via the linguistic similarity. There's a project actually that tracks down all the languages to the very basic and see how far close are two languages. Another is the religion similarity. It's an index that you can construct. So for instance, religion similarity between Greece and the UK. How many Muslims live in Greece? How many Muslims live in the UK? Plus, how many Catholics live in Greece? How many Catholics live in the UK? Plus, 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 Buddhism, Judaism, all nine are well-known, at least, big branches of religion. And then you create an index, actually. It can be 1 to 0. 0, no religion similarity at all. 1, or very, very close when it comes to religion similarity. Can I take questions or...
Can if you want to, but preferably only clarification questions at this point, and then we discuss. Camille?
Okay. So apart from geography, technology, and the cultural things are my last set of things in my model. It's the institutions, which greatly matter, actually. Then we have different sets of institutions here. We have institutions when it comes to quality of regulations, the rule of law, and easiness of doing business. What do you mean by quality of regulations? All these laws, regulations that have to do with the quality of the governance, the corruption, how easily you can fund your new business, whether there are tax distortions. The rule of law has to do with property rights, if you are well protected. About the quality of the judges and the courts, the easiness of doing business is how many days you can actually build up your whole company, you can finance your own company, innovation freedom, etc. So these are very, very important, actually, because if institutions are good, then they create trust. Then they actually help innovation, help the financial system, actually foster economic growth in general. Then you have the knowledge institutions, and this is proxied by human capital. We need good human capital because human capital is complement to technology. Human capital produces technology, like you, one day here, actually, or elsewhere. You can transfer technology, you can contribute to the technological base, and if you become an inventor, actually, you have an even bigger contribution. And then the quality of human capital can be proxied by STEM, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, and all the human resources devoted to science and technology, or whether a country spends a lot on tertiary education or not. These are indices of human capital. We have labor institutions, namely actually the employment protection legislation. So it's good to be protected at your work. But sometimes if you're too much protected then your business needs to upgrade the technology, maybe you resist and you cannot actually let your business to become more high-tech. So it can be good or bad. And then you have trade intensity. This is not an institution, but trade has been recognized in the literature that actually it's a big vehicle of technology transfer. And that was happened in China many, many years ago. So Chinese imported goods, and via imitation, they innovated. So you take one good, a high-tech good, and actually you learn from the good because the good contains technology as well. And then you replicate the good and then you innovate. And I think that's it. I'm not going to go into the details, only one thing, because I have a model which is the dependent variable are the flows of people. And not all countries exchange inventors, of course, right? So either you can have zero values or a positive integer. So these set of models are called count data. And you apply either Poisson or negative binomial techniques. But for Poisson, you should have equal discretion. That means variance equal to the mean. But that's not the case, in our case at least. So you have to apply negative binomial. But then, hey, another problem here. Sometimes the zeros are generated from different mechanisms. So two countries have zero exchange of inventors because they don't have inventors to be exchanged, or because their systems do not record the zeros. So imagine you go to fish one day in a lake and I observe zero. So it's either that you didn't go to fish, you're lazy enough and you're sleeping the whole day, or because you went there and you didn't fish anything. So the zero has two interpretations. So to account for this problem, we use here the zero inflated negative binomial, which is a system actually of a negative binomial equation and a logic model. I will explain this after the lecture. Technicalities, I will skip the technicalities for the time being. I will very, very briefly show you some statistics. 30 OECD countries, 13 years. And actually you can see on average, 18 inventors on average move from country to country. Of course, there's a big standard deviation. Eh? You see the maximum is 2,000. In contrast, about 2,000 migrants move from country to country. So this is a very small number. It's 0.00003% in the labor force. Most of the countries lay in a distance further than 1,500 kilometers. For every country, on average, and for our period, there are 9,000 inventors. As you can see, technologically, culturally, and institutionally, the countries are all over the place. They're not very close to each other, as you can see. And the patenting activity, on average, for every country is 40,000 patents per year. Now, these are my tables, but I will skip. I mean, I have three tables to show to you, but I summarized the results in one table, so I can save some time here. I have a table with
you have another 20 minutes, so you can take your time.
Okay, good. So there's the international inventor flows, one table, because that was my first question, what moves the inventors? The second question had to do what moves the simple non-inventor minds? Excuse me, guys. The first question was what moves the inventors. Then I delved into details and I split the inventors from the high-tech countries and inventors from low-tech countries. And this is table two. Table three discusses my second question, because it's a sub-question. My second question, which was actually what moves the non-inventors. And finally, because endogeneity, reverse causality, so-called, it's a problem everywhere in economics, including my paper here, I did a thorough analysis. And this is a table actually that actually places some credibility on our results. Just to show you. So this is how the gravity model looks like. These are the different classes of geography, the density, the inventors of the origin and destination country, the technological distance, the technological specialization similarity, linguistic proximity, religion proximity, trade, bilateral trade, institutions at the origin, institutions at the destination, human capital at the origin, human capital at destination, and here are some statistics. So this is how a table looks like in my paper. These are the negative binomial estimates, and these are the logit estimates. They show the probability of a variable actually producing zero migration flows. Now, these are just factors. You cannot read them like this. So you have to exponentiate E to the power of every coefficient to get elasticities. And I did this for you because otherwise it's impossible to communicate with you here. I have to go back to my table. Okay. So I'll show you all the results in one common table like this. I think it's better like this. And now I exponentiated all the coefficients, and now you have actually elasticities, percentage changes here. Now what I have here, these are my three questions. This is my question number one. What moves the inventors? Now this question has a sub-question. I split the inventors from inventors moving from high-tech to less high-tech countries, and inventors who move from high-tech to all countries. Then I have inventors from less high-tech countries that move to the most high-tech countries, and inventors from high-tech, from low-tech to all countries. I just need to see whether there is any difference between the inventors coming from different innovative environments. And lastly, I compare the inventors with the migrants. But then I dropped 8 countries because not all countries, surprisingly enough, at least to me, in the OECD, not all countries report with great detail migrants, like France. I was impressed. I was expecting Greece not to report
it's
that.
It's a secular state, it doesn't recognize.
It doesn't recognize. Unbelievable. So I had to drop some countries, 8. Now I ended up having 22, while here we have 30, 30, 30, 30. But anyway, let's see if we can detect some patterns here. As you can see, now the question is how I read these numbers. This 45%. This 45% says the following: that in comparison to an area of less than 300 kilometers, when I move above the 300 kilometers, there are 45% less people moving. So in other words, only the 45% manages of inventors to move out from the area of 300 kilometers. The 45% stays inside the area. 61 means that only 39% from 100 moves out from the area of 1,100 kilometers. And here, who moves above the 1,500 kilometers? Only 20%. So 80% stays in areas below the 1,500 kilometers. So as you can see, as the geography, as the distance progresses, less and less and less inventors move out. And you know, guys, 1,500 kilometers is not a very big distance. But only 20% of the inventors move out, move further than this distance. It's important, actually, the number of inventors at home and the numbers of inventors at the destination and the number of inventors at home. This reads as following. So if the number of inventors at the destination, and my destination, suppose it's the US, increases by 1%, then the inventor inflows to the US increases by 0.87. So I'm very much attracted to other inventors at the destination because that creates jobs, opportunities, synergies, etc. Let's see what's happening here. As you can see, inventors from the very high-tech countries tend to be a bit more mobile from the average country. But if you compare the two groups, inventors from the high-tech countries and inventors from low-tech countries, you can see that inventors from the low-tech countries, like Greece, they don't care about the geography. They just go. Geography is not a problem for them. They just want to leave the country. Geography is flat. Geography is dead.
So it does mean non-significant.
It doesn't mean no. Yes. Okay. So if I'm an inventor and I want to leave my country and my country is low-tech, I don't pay attention to this 1,500 kilometers or to any geographic taxonomy. The world is flat for me. I just go, bam, directly. Which is not the case when it comes to the inventors from the high-tech countries, which are more careful because maybe the opportunity cost of moving is bigger. And if you compare inventors with non-inventors, you can see that the inventors are more mobile. while the non-inventors are more locally restricted. They don't move easily. Or maybe there are other factors apart from geography that are more important to them. So geography, actually, just to come to contribute to that debate, whether the world is flat and whether geography plays no role. No, it plays a role. It plays a huge role, actually. In a very globalized, with a low transaction cost world, where there's plenty of information, I would expect, at least, people to be easygoing, to move around easily, but they don't. Even the inventors do not move. The only people that move very easily are the inventors from the low-tech countries. And this is a graphical representation. These are all the flows of inventors. The inventors coming from the high-tech countries, the inventors coming from the low-tech countries. As you can see, there's a decay in all flows, so geography exerts a heavy toll. People are grounded, actually. They don't move easily. You can see some spikes. And these spikes are actually, this is the area, the area of 700 kilometers. And you can see actually there's this German and the neighbors like Austria and Czech Republic and France and Netherlands. They exchange lots of flows. But after this, after 700 kilometers, everything is dead. Only there's a pickup here. And maybe these are actually flows between Europe and the US or Japan. These are the top inventors from the very high-tech countries. It's the same pattern, actually. It dies out quite fast, actually, here, because these people actually, they have bigger opportunity costs to move. And these are the inventors from the low-tech countries. As you can see, again, there is the decay phenomenon, but it picks up again, because they go, anyway, to the place that they want to go. And if you wonder, this dashed line and the bold line, the dashed line are the actual data, the raw data. The bold line are my the fitted values of my model. So the model does, most of the time, a good job. Now, this is the flows of inventors and the flows of non-inventors. Again, this is the die-out phenomenon. The only difference is the inventors, actually, they are more willing to travel further in space than the non-inventors. Because if you're in the UK and the US or Japan is a very attractive place for you, you will go. If you're a non-inventor, you may have other issues, actually, of going there. For instance, the language, the religion, the institutions, etc. Briefly here, you see, actually, this technological distance, cultural distance, and institutions here. What matters for everybody, especially for the inventors, is the technological similarity. So geography is important, but what is more important for the inventors is the technological similarity, not the technological distance, the technological effort distance. I don't care how much money the UK spends on R&D and on scientists, but I do care if I'm an inventor in the nanotechnology in Greece. I do care if there is a strong nanotechnology sector in the UK, because there I can fit. There I can find people to work with. So see, it's of huge importance, the technological similarity. And of huge importance is the institutions. The institution of the destination, especially the institutions for the people who come from the high-tech countries, for the inventors from the high-tech countries, when they move. So these people look for two things, actually. Of course, geography, and second, technological similarity and institutions. I have to go to a place that I'm a good fit when it comes to my technology, and the place is not corrupted. I can fund my business, the judges are not corrupted themselves, etc. It's very, very important. Anything else doesn't matter. I don't care about the human capital destination or the trade or anything else here. See, if you're a simple migrant, what is important for you? Geography, of course. Cultural things, like linguistic similarity and religion. Institutions, of course, but not that much, as it is for the inventors. The human capital of the place that you go. And if your human capital at home, or your institutions at home, actually, are high enough, you're not actually inclined to move. Which makes sense, actually. So, to summarize, geography emerges everywhere. People are not that mobile. So I don't believe the debate, or actually the debate is a debate, but I take a stance on the debate that geography plays a role and explains economic phenomena. When it comes to inventors, it is technological proximity that matters. When it comes to simple people, it's the cultural proximity. And for both groups, it's the institutions, for sure. I did some analysis, further analysis, about the employment protection. Both inventors and the immigrants like to be protected, like to have stability at their places, at their workplaces. And it's okay for me, for the simple migrants, or for some inventors, but you know, when it comes to innovation, you have two broad innovations. You have the incremental innovation, step-by-step innovation, and then you have the radical innovation. Incremental innovation is performed in the central of Europe, like France and Germany. Radical innovation is performed by the UK and the US. So some stability is important, and most of the countries are European. So some stability, not radical changes at workplaces, you know, you need to know your colleagues to feel comfortable. Then you start to think of ideas and innovate. Well, in the US, it's the opposite. So for the Europeans, employment protection legislation is still important. Okay, the second part, which is very, very small, and I can make it in 5 minutes. This is an innovation function, guys. This is innovation output measured by patents, and this is the local knowledge, and this is the accessible, therefore A, that comes from elsewhere. And in a perfect world, actually, what reaches Greece or the UK is the summation of all knowledge that comes from elsewhere. But in a non-perfect world, you have this phi, actually. Not all knowledge from Spain, Italy, UK reaches Greece. Only a portion comes to Greece. And this A is the R&D stock. The R&D stock proxies for the knowledge. And this, actually, here, phi, is the fitted value of this. So I estimate this model. I take the fitted values. And then I plug these fitted values here. And what I have is, dependent variable is the patents per country, own R&D that comes from all other countries, weighted by the number of inventor flows, R&D that comes from countries who are the top when it comes to patents, R&D that comes from relative countries, countries close to your own technological performance. And as you can see, this is my own R&D. Of course, my own, my homegrown knowledge contributes a lot to my patenting activity, but also knowledge that comes from external countries, all around the countries in the world, also contributes by 0.10%. Knowledge that comes only from the top innovative countries contributes about 0.12%. And knowledge that comes actually from countries that are better than I am in the innovation ranking contributes by 0.10%. So it's important. And so my estimates, which is 10% or 12% or 14%, are very close in the literature with Migueles and Moreno and Crescenzi and Cagliati, that they find also 15 to 27%. Or 14% hand in Confer in Loisel, so very close there. And I'm not very close to the literature that captures actually how foreign knowledge reaches a country via citations, via FDI, via trade. I'm very close actually to the literature, actually, which makes sense, that discusses mobility of inventors. Summing up, policy implications. Well, I stay pretty much here, the obvious, enhance the labor mobility. Create the inventor's visa, like in the US, you have the entrepreneurship visa. Open up actually the borders to the very, very talented people, like the inventors. Remove barriers and regulations, obstacles, make the wages flexible, the time flexible, accommodate these people when it comes actually to the housing, to the facilities. Make people move, because these people have important contribution on innovation. And if you take a hard stance on immigration policy, then it's your country that actually won't benefit in the future, because you lose the brightest and the best. And now it's a few things about Greece. If I have some time, or it can be during our discussion, because I need to show some graphs about.
Take another five minutes.
5 minutes, okay. So the red line are the immigrants. Now the Greek emigrants, people who leave the country, as you can see after 2008, it increases exponentially. While Greek inventors always were leaving the country, actually, as you can see, around the Olympic Games, there was the pattern was improving when it comes to emigrants, while the inventors always actually had the tendency to leave because institutions are very important, technological proximity, etc. And they tend to go.
Could just go back, but in the year 2000, it was very low. For those who are inventors who are leaving, something happens in 2002.
Mm-hmm. I don't have data before for Greece, before 2000, but I think all this, the prosperity, or actually the good education quality, the masters, actually the more good you are, the more you have a tendency to move if your country doesn't have the sound institutions. And probably people actually, that was the golden years in Greece, and actually people felt liberated, they were very much mobile at the time. And they didn't have maybe a big opportunity cost moving, or they were thinking it's easy to come back. And I guess that's the reason, because there's a sharp, as you know, this increase actually here, and pretty much it stayed all over the place with a small drop actually here. This is the aftermath of the Olympic Games, so people thought that maybe the country is doing okay until actually the whole thing, the death thing emerged. This is a very weird pattern, actually. It's not easily explainable, but the only explanation they have is because if a country reaches a high level of innovation, you have many scientists, and there are many scientists, and the R&D spend was okay at the time, then people had the skills to move.
Can I also ask something on this? So this is not actual moves, this is people filing on a different a patent in a different address. What is it?
It is filing and living, actually, to different places.
But let's say I'm a inventor in Greece in 2000, and then I move
to France, for instance.
I move in 2001 to France, but I only filed my patent in France in 2006. Let's say, yeah. So will you record me in 2001 or in 2006?
2006.
So then, you know, it could be that inventors left earlier, but then it took them a while.
The patent was realized later.
So and the legal process is slow.
Yeah. In France.
Exactly. Yeah, the patent office are very slow. Actually, the European patent office is very slow compared to the US patent office. There are so many examiners examining your patent, your citations, and the fields and the scope, etc. Where do the Greek migrants go? The immigrants, the single-minded people, or the non-immigrants go to Germany and the UK and the Netherlands. Inventors traditionally in Greece go to the US. More than 50% go to the US, and then to Germany and the UK and Switzerland.
So Claire, on the first column, these simple immigrants could be doctors, scientists,
engineers, hairdressers,
bankers.
Anybody, unfortunately, the OECD data do not allow us to separate actually the profiles. But there's now a project run by the French guys that try to disentangle actually all different backgrounds, income background and educational background. This is just aggregate data. I use the airline actually. Images here to give a fancier graph. I've got the information I gave you before. So this is Greece, and you see actually the round bold actually balls where the Greeks go. The big ball is the big mask of the US and Germany and the UK, and maybe a few people go to Japan. Now, foreign vendors that come to Greece. You can see some from the US, Canada, Cyprus, Germany, the UK, Spain, and here is the list. Inventor inflows to Greece. Every year, 2000, two people. 2001, five people. These are the good years of Greece, right? 2003, five people, etc. Year by year, and these are the origins of these people. I mean, it's the US, 14 people. Germany, nine people. Maybe these people are Greeks. Greek of Greek origin, when they come to Greece. Some statistics for Greece. I'm not going to go into all of these things. These are my variables, actually, as you can see. On average, 10 people move from Greece, inventors. 18 people in my sample, as you saw before. What is interesting here is the R&D spending, which is very low compared to my sample average, and that's a problem in Greece. But it's also a problem in Greece. It's the when you see the regulatory quality, easiness of doing business, rule of law, that are consistently under the mean. But what is good in Greece is the STEM people, the science engineering people, which are very close to my OECD average. So there are many people who have good skills. And the R&D, I think, the tertiary, spending on tertiary education. Traditionally, the government spent on tertiary education, but the problem is the spending is not effective. It's too big, but not effective. Patent applications in Greece increase pretty much every year. As you can see, all this, what Vasily said, there are some lags actually when you file for a patent. Researchers per millions per population, it's stable throughout all the years. You see the big decline in GDP per capita. So you see the crisis, more than 45% of the real income was lost. Top marginal tax rate, it was 38% in 2000, then it dropped, and sharply it increased in 2008 or 9, here to 40-41%. Employment protection legislation became less strict. Now you can easily fire or hire people easier compared to the past. Financial development is pretty much a mess here because it creates an uncertain environment to finance your business. Less shiny images, more and more out of 11 million Greeks, almost 6 million are inactive. I mean, old people, babies, prisoners, soldiers. Then there are about 4 million people employed, 1.3 million unemployed, so this is the salvation of the labor force. And among the unemployed, 642,000 people are the young Greeks, below the age of 35. And job losses. As you can see, retail, construction, and manufacturing are the big sectors that lost actually lots of people. Education as well. Public administration, these are the big sectors. Finally, exodus of talents. Well, there is a survey, a project from the University of Macedonia, conducted by Lois Labrianidis. He estimated that the last 5 years, about 200,000 Greeks, overeducated Greeks, not just immigrants, highly talented people, left the country. So on a macro level, this is called brain drain. On the micro level, for these people, it's good because it's all about opportunities, right? So they were looking for better opportunities, and eventually they develop, or they will be developing, an extrovert mentality, and they will acquire skills that they wouldn't acquire in Greece. This is good for them. What I also find is that in Greece we have 673 outstanding researchers / inventors. And outstanding researchers, the researcher that receives more than 17,000 citations for his work. So these are the most cited people, and only 14 of them live in Greece. The rest of them live in the US, most of them UK, Germany. So there is talent, but the talent does not stay in Greece. But Greece is able to create talented people that flourish and become very good elsewhere. So what do you suggest here? Well, I'm not that a gloomy person, and I can see opportunities everywhere. So instead of calling the whole phenomenon, the macro phenomenon, brain drain, you can call it brain circulation. That's not that, you know, you recycle your brain. It's what the country can do. So there are three challenges. Of course, you have to sustain links with the new generation of Greeks, the international Greeks, like you people here, if you're here. The country needs to have some links, actually. Because in the literature, there's this ethnic-driven knowledge flows, but emigrant scientists like you are here, somehow in a contractual or in a friendly basis, you have links with your home, you transfer knowledge, you invite people from your home here, you spread your knowledge actually, and this is good for you and for the country. Create an environment, which is the most important thing for me, for the people to return, because if you ask any Greek person, would you like to come back to Greece? he or she will say yes yesterday, if the conditions, if the environment is enabling, if the environment embraces people. So that means actually you can have two windows of opportunity. Let people stay for 3 years abroad and then invite them back, because then they bring substantial skills, and put them in certain positions. Then invite people who have lived 8 to 10 people abroad and put them in a different position, in a leading position actually. And have good managers and employers in all pretty much organizations, especially public organizations, so they can cultivate, they can foster, they can sustain these skillful people. And third scenario, at all costs, try to keep a critical mass of Greeks in Greece. Because if the international Greeks return to Greece and there is not this critical mass, it's very difficult actually to cultivate and develop further their skills. I think that's it. Thank you very much for your patience.
Thank you, Claire. I have to say, you confused me. You put the 36 slides at the end
of this. This is the appendix of my tables,
okay,
actually.
Yeah, that's
right. I don't know.
Okay, we can open it up for questions, comments from the floor.
And Vasilikou allowed, the political momentum at the time in Greece is around these lines, actually. How to...
Yes. We did have Lois Labrianidis presenting this seminar series last year, if I remember correctly. He was also talking about
the
project, but also the website that is not active yet.
Not active yet. Yeah. Hopefully it will be activated soon.
Okay. Questions?
Yes. Thanks. It's obviously very sophisticated, rigorous research, so it's impressive. I was thinking of I'm not going to challenge on the equations or surprising bit, but on the policy implications. Crudely, the interest for any particular country is to stop people, stop inventors leaving, mm-hmm. but to allow inventors to return. Mm-hmm. The policy implication here, I can see, as you say, in the current period, mm-hmm. a lot of the political narrative is consistent with your three bullet points here. But in order to have diasporic Greeks return, you need the financial incentives mm-hmm. and the cultural positive attitudes.
Definitely.
And I would be doubtful on both points.
So,
in your university, for example, mm-hmm. Or in the educational sector more generally, the university sector in Greece, mm-hmm. I just thought there would be a couple of queries about how academics would respond to the idea of a diasporic academic returning to the department with the kind of incentives which would bring them back.
Yes.
So we have some kind of disjunction. Just to take that example, I'm not singling out universities, but we have some kind of disjunction, contrast here. We talk the blah blah, the political discourse of this is the way forward, but in reality, on the ground, we don't have the money to attract them. Even if we had the money to attract them, culturally, we are not. Extroverts in welcoming them back.
Mm. You raised a couple of issues, but I would agree with you. What I'm saying here is it takes time to do all these structural changes, to create trust, to improve all these back institutions that actually push people to leave the country. But meanwhile, if you do 2-3 simple things, like Simple Links, there is a nice private initiative. Brain Gain Plus. So all the intellectual Greeks who live mostly in the UK, and I think they have a meeting tomorrow and I will join them, they brainstorm how to link people in various ways, maybe in social media, etc. But if the government has a plan how to relocate people back, meanwhile working on the institutions, that would be great. Now if you ask me, I'm a totally returnee. I spent 11 years of my life in the US and the Netherlands. So in the middle of the crisis, I returned back in Greece. So I didn't pay attention to utility functions or to gravity models. But then while in Greece, I kept my own foot in the Netherlands, or maybe here, because I tried to connect and bridge people and my university. And what my university do, and in other universities, we have visitors. So these visitors actually, they don't come for the monetary payoffs. They come because they, it's like the ethnic knowledge. They want to contribute because they acquire knowledge from Greece, because the Greek education system is quite good, at least in the elementary or undergraduate level. But then it's not good when it comes to postgraduate because the money is not there, or the money is misspent. But then eventually you feel gratitude to your country and you want to return back, not 100%, but with one foot maybe. And then actually you are the bridge of bridging people and carrying knowledge on getting your students back to your previous post. I think this is a kind of temporary solution till any Greek government really listens to the Greeks, how to improve our country, and eventually all this beautiful capital, human brains, can be relocated back. So the universities, I think, slowly, they start understanding this, because there are many universities which lose people, actually. Mm-hmm. People leave. And the existing people cannot take all the courses and all the research, so they need people. And the only way to keep people is not money, of course, in Greece. It's either to promote people faster, to make their lives easier, especially the junior people, or to allow people to take sabbatical leaves for 3 years, unpaid, of course, for 1 year, or actually to go like me for 3 months somewhere else and try to create actual linkages. It's a temporary solution. But I think, and that's the last note, all Greek problems can be write it off, you can write them off, erase them immediately with a pen. It's a matter of political willingness. It's not difficult problems. People everywhere in the world have done it and have done it better. We don't have to reinvent the wheel. It's a political decision. Get the political parties outside of the universities. Make the universities more entrepreneurial. Mm. Not public sector like universities. Put entrepreneurship in the public sector, etc.
Why do I feel it's about to wake up?
I don't know how we orchestrate that, but always the person who is sitting or standing here is always the optimist in the room.
So you have to be.
In all senses. Can I ask a question? I think what you haven't told us about the data, and then I'm going to link it to Greece, is the quality of the patents,
mm-hmm.
And also the, you know, if it's, I don't know how they call them, like a second, so you know, like you have one invention and you patent it in the US,
yes,
and then you go to Greece, you patent it in different places because you want to have full coverage. So how many of them are that second thing? And I'm asking this because I know from Yannis Kaplan that there's a lot of translation taking place here. Yeah? So you submit your patent to the European office.
Mm-hmm.
And then, because you happen to be Greek, you also submit it to Greece, because also you don't trust how fast
the
procedure will last from the European Union to translate it to Greece, so you say, okay, I will actually do that. So, is the innovation activity of, well, I don't know of Greeks, but in Greece, reflecting actual knowledge creation, and you're talking about ideas carriers, producers of ideas, mm-hmm. and things like that, or does it reflect, you know, maybe the institutional problems of the country, and you know, the what is being patented there is something that people feel it will take me longer to wait for the Greek authorities to
mm-hmm.
to translate
mm-hmm.
my patent, so I will just do
mm-hmm.
it.
Good questions. So in my sample, I have only patents from the EPO, not from Greek local or German local patent offices. EPO, USPTO, and Japanese Patent Office, all there.
So it's just the address that people declare?
Exactly, there.
Okay.
So I'm talking about strong patents, because if you believe in your patent, you're going to file in the biggest office, because the market is bigger there, but then you pay bigger fees. So I have only these patents, because I have country-level data, and I don't have individual, I mean, I don't know how many citations every individual gets, or actually, maybe I can collect this for the whole country, actually. But where you file, it's a strong indication if you believe in your patent. So don't have Greeks who patent in the Greek patent office.
And then, okay, good. And then does this also exclude So sometimes the individual files the patent, but often the company files the patent.
Yes.
And you exclude the companies.
It's the companies and the individuals here. So if the individual has the patent on his own, it's on his own. But if it's a company, then it goes to the company. So I have just one entity. In the US it's different. I mean, if you are an inventor and you belong in a company, then the patent belongs to the company.
But then you cannot move. I mean, you know, if Google files a patent.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. But here you have only patents that belong to inventors. Mm-hmm. That's it. Because otherwise it's difficult to track mobility of companies. Because more companies are
everywhere. Okay. Angelo, you have a question?
Yes. I really enjoyed the presentation. I'm not an economist, and I found very, very easy to understand. I have two comments. First of all, you had an index about culture, then about one about religion.
Yeah.
A trivial comment would be: I think there would be a matter of endogeneity there. I mean, I think the two should be related, or at least you know, the one should actually include the other. Or you can talk
no,
more about
they're not related at all. Language is it's a dummy. Either you speak the same language or not. Religion is an index, it's a composite index.
So the cultural index is about the language?
No, the cultural is about religion. Either you have the same share of Muslims plus Catholic plus Greek Orthodox, it's an index, right? The other is a dummy.
Okay.
And from correlation, they're not related at all.
Okay. The second thing is, I was wondering if measuring innovation by just looking at patent applicants and inventors is a good way to measure innovation in general, especially in a context like the Greek context, where we have low institutional capacity. So maybe you have someone coming from abroad in Greece, bringing a new idea about how to kind of deal and engage with institutions, or in fact not to engage with institutions. I mean, we have these examples from people from Germany who actually come in, they make some kind of partnership with agricultural producers, and they kind of bypass the state. And the great economic value, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's working very well for them. You know, they're innovators, but your index would not actually capture them, right?
No. So you're right. Patents, it's a proxy. Not the perfect, it's a proxy measure of innovation. But look, there's the trade secrets, the copyrights, the lead time ahead type of things to protect your invention. Like Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola doesn't have patents, it's a trade secret. So one way, a systematic way to do serious research is to proxy innovation by patents. Because it's very costly to file for a patent. It's you can wait for years. So probably you believe in your idea, in your invention, but it becomes innovation later. And maybe that will have also tremendous implications in the market. Maybe some patents never reach the market, but some other patents do reach the market. So it is a proxy, but it's the best proxy, because otherwise it's anything else that you say, I totally agree, but it's anecdotal evidence. You have to do a survey, who went to Greece, what he advised, how much of this advice was heard, eventually followed. So it's soft data. With patents, actually, you have real data, but yes, you capture a part of the innovation, not the whole thing. That's true. But that's the best you can do in this innovation literature. But we have the concerns, and this is one of them.
I mean, especially in this context, I think the importance of data.
But be careful to disentangle innovation from entrepreneurship. Mm-hmm. What you're talking is closer to entrepreneurship. Mm-hmm. So you have an idea about an agri product, and I go to Greece because the soil is very fertile and there's microclimate there, and I implement this idea. Like US people go to Israel, but this is entrepreneurship. Mm-hmm. And there are measures there, early entrepreneurial activity, birth and death of businesses, but I'm talking about innovation. So very close, but still there's some difference.
Okay, can I bring another question relating a bit more to the policy prescriptions? I mean, the point about circulating brains and then make sure they return back to Greece. From a kind of global benevolent dictator point of view, you'd say, well, I need to pull resources together.
Exactly.
Concentrate and then yeah. So I don't want to disperse all my scientists to all parts of the world. I want to put them together in a lab. And so there's a benefit there from concentration. And if you, so I imagine if I thought about like how the US developed the capacity that developed, apart from the military defense complex and things, you would think first came the capacity or the institutions, and then people moved in, some homegrown, but a lot of migrants, as you also saw. So if you go to the policy application, do you think there's a case at least to be made that maybe resources shouldn't be allocated on trying to attract people and let people where they individually decided to go? And then if and when industrial policy or sectoral incentives or you know private entrepreneurial activity develops the sectors and the you know the areas where product innovation can happen, then people will move, and maybe they won't be Greeks, they will be Bangladeshi and whatever.
Mm-hmm. The idea is not to bring only the Greeks back to Greece. The idea is to bring the brightest and the best people. Personally, I don't care if we have Greeks in Greece. We need the bright people, and it's good actually not to have only Greeks, because look at the US. I mean, you need to mix and match, actually. You need new blood. Technology is about disruption. I'm not a believer of incremental technology. You need actually, look at UK, look France, look Germany actually. It's not a homogeneous country. I mean, all of them have more than 3% of the population which are foreigners, and these foreigners are important people. So you need to attract important people. And in Greece right now, there are big incubators like the Cube, the Coralia, the Orange Grove from Dutch Embassy. You go there, you have seminars, you have an idea, so this entrepreneurship, I have an idea, and I want to implement my idea, but then I don't know how to finance my idea. I'm looking for consultants, I'm looking for new markets. And these people create this environment. And they attract actually, so the Dutch Embassy has a beautiful floor, very versatile, flexible. Young people go there, below the age of 25, and they link their products with the Dutch people. Wine, olives, some shoes, very notable shoes. So there are these places actually. And these places, like that was the case in Israel, they push actually the government and the institutions to create new institutions to accommodate these people. Because that's the only way of growing. And actually over the years and over time, more people, either inventors or entrepreneurs, can join this effort and the country can grow.
Could pick up the point about kind of indigenous will to innovate in this fashion. Some years ago, I was a member of the National Council for Research and Technology in Greece, and one of the most striking presentations we had was in terms of an EU-funded program, Synergasia, which was for a collaboration between research centres, universities, institutes, and local entrepreneurs. Mm. And the striking presentation was a map of the EU27 at that stage, and lots of dots showing the number of such projects or such spend by the European Union. There was just the one dot in Greece. Even Lithuania, we couldn't see the borders of Lithuania because of the red dots on the map. But the serious point there seems to be perhaps rather more in terms of institutional capacity. So I can see your point, of course, that it's political will, and if leadership at the top changed, there can be momentum for reform. But this is an example of something where domestic political leadership is irrelevant. There's a funding from Brussels under the EU programme, and people could get together between research centres, entrepreneurs, etc., and they weren't. So that seems to be something which was either on the ground, it's certainly a matter of institutional processes, the ability to welcome innovation in individual institutions, etc. And that would take us beyond your point that it's simply politics.
It's like the chicken makes the egg or the vice versa.
Indeed.
Sometimes people push institutions, institutions push people. So if all Greek universities have as a working language English, then all exchange programs would be easier fostered there.
Yes.
Now you cannot exchange, you cannot go and teach the Greek university because simply you don't speak Greek. the knowledge is in master programs in some key universities. But so this is actually a regulation that can be easily abolished, and then boom.
Fine, but public opinion would not countenance the idea that Greek universities will speak teach in English. Public opinion, not political opinion.
Yeah, maybe it's because sometimes the politicians are not conveying the message right to the people. Because if you say that, well, if you switch our language into English, at least in university, then you can create the value and money. Mm-hmm. Foreign students can come, pay here, they're going to be okay. Actually, you'll be better off. Your kids will receive a better education because they will be exposed to the national competition. If we convey this message in this way, I think the young generation of Greeks will definitely be convinced. But if they actually go for political purposes and say, well, we're going to lose our identity and we're Greek Orthodox and we need only Greek people, of course, actually. So, but I think the time
And none of your colleagues would have such attitudes.
I think the old generation would have an attitude against, simply because they're not able. It's a matter of fear, actually, not against, they're not xenophobic. But if you're not a top performer, you don't like to have maybe mathematics or English or Chinese or anything else. But the young people who came recently back, they got to have this, because otherwise there's not a way of making money and staying in your country. So it's a matter of inefficiency and not being able, actually. And these people, unfortunately, and I would agree with you, have a big voting decision in the university. They elect the deans and the chairs.
Indeed.
Sluggishness of the system, but it will change eventually because these people will retire and people push, young people push. The retirees and people who want to stay, they push because they have nothing to lose right now. I can easily move to another university. And that would be a loss for them. I'm not talking, that's an example, not even for me. But then it would be a bigger cost for them, actually, to sustain all this thing. So they have to listen. And they're listening, but they go very slowly. And that's my biggest critique.
Okay, if there's another question, I'll ask my last question, and then we can close the seminar. On the set of results that you showed for the determinants of patterns, so the output side of it, there were... And you know, surprisingly, kind of big elasticities for the domestic
R&D,
basically.
Yes.
Okay. Do you have a measure to compare? I mean, you know, if you were in the old world, if you were presenting standardized beta coefficients, I would know which of the two effects is bigger in a way, because you can say, okay, the external R&D linked through innovation through the FIs. Matters, but you can also say, well, yeah, but I'm sending out people who, had they stayed here, they would be included in the bigger elasticity effect. So do you have a measure of how the two elasticities compare? I mean, the number of the second one is smaller, I know, but like
yes,
also...
Yes, the own elasticity, the own R&D, is overestimated, I think, because the external inventor-weighted R&D, it's not the only channel. You can have R&D that comes from the country via the FDI, via trade, via other mechanisms. So because I didn't include this mechanism into the model, then actually the own R&D is inflated. In another paper that I have with Mike Tsionas and Kyriakos Grivas, we include four mechanisms, four channels, and then you see the own R&D deflates by 20%. It's not zero